radio made it possible for actors to become law-abiding citizens who paid their taxes, who were able to buy homes and automobiles and raise families and send them to nice schools, and maybe their kids could go to a university, which most of us didn't have a chance to do. Always prior to radio, except for a very few, actors were vagrants. They, in Elizabethan times, you know, they were just picked up off the street. They were prostitutes and beggars and goodness knows what. So radio gave actors a chance to be normal, unquote, human beings, to be busy, to be respected in their trade, and to make some money in it.
Return with us now to those thrilling days of yesteryear.
Tonight, Les Tremaine remembers radio.
Told me that he had been working now and then on his night off
on a program called The Night Court on WCFL. And he introduced me to the man down at the station, whose name was Howard Keegan. He was the production manager of the station. And he married an actress named Ilk Deal, who was also... was a very fine actress, and she worked on these shows, too. Now, at the same time, WGN in Chicago, which was owned by the Chicago Tribune, was called the world's greatest newspaper, which is where they got their call letters, was having a huge contest. And they advertised in the Tribune, come one, come all, the entertainers needed, etc., etc. Well, at that time, I was a very serious, dramatic actor, unquote, and very young and sincere and intense. And I have been doing a lot of poetic dramas and so on. And I had a girlfriend, and she said, Les, why don't you get into this contest? Why don't you go down? And it was being held at the Aragon Ballroom on the north side of Chicago. I applied, and on the appointed morning, I went up to the place. And I'm not kidding, there was a line of four people abreast all around the block waiting to get into this place. And they didn't lose any money, because everybody was charged the admission fee. And in those days, I was pretty broke. I didn't have it, you know. But I don't know where I got it, but I had enough money to pay the admission fee. And when we got inside, they were going around the ballroom in a concentric circle. And then you cut through all of this crowd and went into a little doorway with a green portiere over it, on it. And inside was one of the old square microphones. And you did your thing. There was a young chap in front of me with a bristling red mustache, and we got to talking. His name was Murray Forbes. And he, when he got inside, he did a number of impersonations, Jimmy Cagney, Edward G. Robinson, etc. And they liked him. Then I did my poetic reading, and I heard from them later. And one of the wildest looking women I have ever met in my life was one of the, one of the select audience who was listening to all these contestants. And she called me later on to work on some programs she was doing, cut-down versions of half-hour plays from the legitimate theater that she was adapting for 15-minute to half-hour radio shows. This young man took me down, introduced me, and they put me right on, and I played an Italian and a Swede and a Japanese and a couple of other characters, you know, these various characters who were brought up before the night court judge, and it was strictly a comedy show, and a lot of it was ad-lib. It was a lot of fun.
Chicago, WMAQ.
This program came to you from Chicago.
The Columbia Workshop today originated at WBBM Chicago.
This is the Blue Network.
WBBM Air Theater, Wrigley Building, Chicago.
Some of them were pretty... pretty downbeat. None of them were decorated very well, except I think WNAQ, which was over on the river, in, I think, the Daily News building in Chicago. They built the studios either after the building was built or along with the building of the building. And they were really professional studios, but some of them were made over office building space, or lofts in, manufacturing-type buildings, where they had some sort of soundproofing on the wall. Sometimes it was drapes. Sometimes it was an acoustical composition board of some kind. Sometimes it was just a room. And if they found that, as we call it, the sound was too live, then they did something to muffle it or baffle it in some way. I would like to mention one thing in referring to WCFL and WIBO and KYW and all those early radio stations, which is now, KYW was from Philadelphia, and it was in Chicago for a number of years and then was moved back to Philadelphia. But at one time, KYW was in Chicago. I worked for 8 months in radio before I made any money at all. You just did these things because you were young, you were eager, you were intense, and you loved the theater and acting and so on. And I had had a great deal of experience by the time I got into radio in 1931, but besides, you were broke. As you say, these were depression years, and where could you go but up? And you were acting, and you were working with other professional actors, whether you were paid or not. We considered ourselves professionals. And as I say, 8 months went by before I made any money, and then I started making $2 a program, $2.50. And then one day I heard about a man named Blair Walliser, who had several shows on WGN. And I went in to see him, and this lovely young girl, Josephine Mahoney, I'll never forget her. She said, "Oh, you just missed him. He went down in the elevator. Hurry, and maybe you can catch him on the street." I said, "I don't know him. What does he look like?" He said, "Well, he got a black hat on and an overcoat." So I grabbed the next elevator and went down. And I met him out on the street, and I ran up to him, and I, without any preliminaries, blurted out what I wanted. And he kind of grinned. He was a very young man himself. And he had Uncle Quinn's Scallywags or something like that. And WGN always had contest programs on with Quinn Ryan, who was a big name at that time in radio. Anyway, he said, "Well, sure." He says, "I'm on my way up to the Drake Hotel now," which was a bit of a walk. And that's where some of their studios were. And he said, "Come on along. I think there's something in the show I'm doing, Uncle Quinn's something or other." And I went. And I didn't have a cent in my pocket. And it was cold, and I'd been down all day trying to find some sort of a program to work on, you know. And I went up with him, I did this show, and he paid me $5. Well, this was a tremendous stake. I mean, my golly. But he didn't pay me then. He said, "I'm doing another one at 9:30 tonight." Now, it was still light out when I had met him on the street. He says, "If you want to hang around or come back," he says, "you can do that one. It'll be $7.50. Well, I didn't have any money, and I was too proud to tell him so. So I waited in the lobby of the Drake Hotel, starving to death. You know, I was always a hungry kid. And then at, 8:30, I suppose, I went back upstairs and we rehearsed the show and did it at 9:30, and by 9:45 I was out of there and I had a check for $12.50 in my pocket, and that was big money, believe me. And when I started on these programs where I wasn't being paid, one night everything stopped. The production manager, Howard Keegan, dashed into the studio where we were rehearsing, and he said, "Come on, everybody, it's time. Come on out and listen." Well, I didn't know what it was all about, so I went out to listen, and it turned out to be Fu Manchu. The premiere performance of Fu Manchu on, let me see. We did it from CBS, but I think the outlet in Chicago was WGN, even though it was a CBS net. And so we all listened to the program, and we were enthralled, and it was beautifully done. One of the things I remember them Howard saying, "And it's commercial." And I hate to dwell on how young and naive I was, but I finally had to ask, and I didn't know the difference. The whole gist of the story is I didn't know the difference between a sustaining and a commercial program, and I had to ask and be told what it was. Interesting comment.
Italian Bomb presents the First Night of Program, a copyrighted feature, Coast to Coast. See you at a time on the Great White Way, and once again, ladies and gentlemen, you're invited to attend an opening night performance in the Little Theater off Times Square. There'll be plenty of traffic tonight, so let's get an early start for the theater. Here's my cab, once you step in. All right, driver, up Broadway. Ticket ready, please. Have your ticket ready, please. Good evening, Mr. First Manager. Curtain in 2 minutes. Thank you. We'll go right in. All right, we have just a moment now before the play begins.
I see that the title of this evening's dramatic offering is Love and Gazooza, an original comedy romance by Virginia Safford, co-starring Barbara Luddy and Les Tremaine. The story is pure fiction and does not refer to real people or to actual events. And now before first curtain, let's listen to Eric Segerquist and his famous orchestra.
First Nighter went on the air for the first time in 1931, and I was not on the first show, but I was on some of the 1931 shows, just playing parts. And this man, Blair Walliser, I spoke of earlier, called me in for an audition once at WGN for a new show. There was a lady out from New York named Anne Ashenhurst, who later became Anne Hummert, Frank Hummert's wife. And there was an agency in Chicago and in New York called Blackett, Sample, and Hummert. This lady was listening to us as we auditioned. And I won the audition and became Helen Trent's original leading man. Grant Douglas was his name. And this was in 1934. Well, let's see. There were shows like I was Coach Hardy for a while in that great old stalwart, Jack Armstrong, the All-American Boy. Get in and fight, you bet, Jack. And I was Bob in Betty and Bob, which was a very popular daytime strip show. Five a week, five across the board, as we used to say. We did a recording of that 6 weeks in advance of the air show for the simple reason that although we had full network, both NBC and CBS, which meant two live broadcasts every day, we also, 6 weeks in advance of those live broadcasts, did recordings of the show so that they could be processed and shipped out all over the country to spot stations. So that we had coverage, complete coverage, all over the United States. Betty and Bob. Oh, my goodness. There's so many of them. Highlights. Fu Manchu, I worked any number of times. And that was a dress show. And as I told you, that was in 1931 when we heard the original, the premiere. And as I said, I was not making any money. When I got a call for this show, primarily because Fred Ibbett, who was connected with it, as I recall, wanted Englishmen, and my bio stated that I had been born in London. Well, I didn't any longer sound like an Englishman, excuse me, because I'd had it beaten out of me by these kids in school. Anyway, Fred called me, and I did the show. I did a young Jewish art shopkeeper who was killed by the needles in the golden pomegranates in a beautiful cask because he put his fingers in the holes and the poison was injected into his fingers and he died a horrible screaming death. And it was a great part, you know. For that show, which was done in a regular studio, one of the nice CBS studios, but not with a stage, we had an audience on the floor level with us. But we had to dress for this show, which meant I had to buy a dinner jacket. Well, you don't just buy a dinner jacket. You buy the shirt, you buy the tie, the bow tie, you buy shoes and socks and the whole works. And I didn't have the money. And it's funny, I don't remember where I got the money. I suppose I was making a little bit at that time. And it was $15 I paid. I didn't rent one. I bought a tux, so I don't remember where I got it or anything. It must have been great, but I had the dinner jacket for the show. About 1933, I guess, 1934, Grand Hotel came along. Now, Don Ameche had been playing Betty and Bob. He had been Bob. I replaced him on that. Then, in 1935, I replaced him as the leading man on Grand Hotel. I had worked Grand Hotel many times before that, and as a matter of fact, they hadn't been sure they were going to use Don As I recall the situation, they didn't want to dissipate him or diffuse the image or whatever you want to call it by having him do two shows for them. But Don was top man in Chicago at that time, and there was nobody else who could really play it the way he did. And I had an opportunity to audition for the lead in Grand Hotel before it went on the air, but like several other fine actors in Chicago, we didn't get it, and Don did. Well, when he went out to pictures to Hollywood, he took First Nighter with him for a while, but of course he wanted too much money. You know, the agents in Hollywood and the movie business, and he was a movie star, so Campana couldn't afford him. I was already doing the lead on Grand Hotel, which had stayed in Chicago, for which we also dressed with the striped trowel and the Oxford gray jacket and so on. And they started looking around. This was in 1937 now. They started looking around for a leading man for First Nighter. And you must forgive me, because some of this sounds like an agent, and it doesn't sound as if I have any humility, but this is the way it happened. They were interviewing movie stars, Broadway actors, all sorts of actors all over the United States, and they couldn't find anyone, because radio acting is really a special technique. There are certain things you must know in order to come across and be sincere and to have an audience accept you as a human being. You don't project as you do in the theater, even if you can. Motion pictures are all visual. Sure, you talk a lot, but it's a visual medium primarily, just as television is. The thing people must remember is that radio was just one of your senses, outside of your beautiful imagination, which you used constantly, we made you work, was your ear. And everything we did had to depict a character, a situation, whatever it was, through the ear. All we have is our voice and some sound effects. And there are funny stories about that, too. Anyway, it finally occurred to me, since I was a hard-driving, ambitious young man, that I was doing the leading man on their other show. Why wasn't I even asked to audition for them on this show? So I went to them and I said, why not? You know, Don was doing them both. You accepted me for Grand Hotel. Why can't I at least audition for you? Well, they hemmed and hawed around. They finally said yes. Now, I knew what they wanted. And I've never told anybody this. This is a first. I knew that they wanted Don Ameche. Well, in some of our work, we didn't sound too unlike each other. And there was a certain delivery that was uniquely ours, shall I say. Well, I went down to RCA on the ninth floor of the Merchandise Mart, and I asked a lovely girl, Betty Mitchell, who is now gone, if I could have a couple of records of Betty and Bob when Don was doing it, just to listen to his delivery, even though I had worked with him for years and knew him well. I wanted to listen specifically. And she said yes. And she got me the records, and I sat in the studio and listened to them and gave her a big kiss and said thank you, and she said good luck. And I went upstairs to the 19th floor of the Merchandise Mart, and they threw some script at me and said, okay, let's go ahead, let's hear you. And I did a reasonable facsimile of Don Ameche, and I got the part. Very simple. I hated to admit it to myself, but I knew that I and no one was going to get this until they had to compromise and take somebody because of the time element. I knew that if I didn't play Don Ameche for the first two shows or so, I was going to be in trouble. And gradually I weaned away from it, you see, and became myself, and nobody knew it, and it worked out beautifully, because of all the things I have done, First Nighter, and I left it in 43, after being on it for some 12 years, 7 or 8 as the leading man, of all the things I have done in show business, in theater, television, pictures, and radio, the thing people always remember first is First Nighter. I am eternally grateful for that. It was a great thing for me, and it was an identification point for me. And nothing has ever come anywhere near it. The public just loved the show. It was a big, popular show. It was neck and neck with Lux Radio Theater for years, and it just had Barbara Luddy and myself. I mean, there were no movie stars on it.
Come in. I bid you welcome to my house. Come in.
Oh, how lovely and cool.
Hey, nice old place you have here.
Gracias, senor. It's the etiquette.
How's that?
It is your house, senor.
Oh, no, no, I couldn't take it. Yes. I see what you mean. Thanks.
Coming to the patio. Pedro has cool drinks waiting for us.
Oh, look, a fountain. And the flowers. Esteban, Evie, boy, it's heavenly.
Heavenly now that you are here, Emilita. Senor, what will you have?
Is that Cazuza?
You like Cazuza, senor?
He's had it everywhere we've been in Mexico.
Thanks. You know, a fizzy pop like this would be a sensation in the States. I'd like to know who makes it.
Oh, Emilita, so many times I dream in my mind of you, sitting here by my phone. Well, you sent me away from New York.
I didn't send you away.
But you gave me, what you say, the fence?
The gate. But I said we'd always be friends.
Oh. My heart breaks. I come home to my hacienda, but always I think of you. Always I say to myself...
Stephen, please, not out in public.
Don't mind me. I'm strolling around the garden.
Everything is yours, senor. Pick all the flowers. Oh, Emily.
Stephen.
My little coffee blossom.
I was... You're what?
Coffee brought
you. Oh, Stephen, we must never, never quarrel again.
But she's nothing to quarrel about now, my sweet. You have come. Each day I think, mañana she will see her mistakes. Mañana she will come. So now, it is mañana.
You mean you've been expecting me?
I knew you would realize how much you love me.
You were waiting for me. You're the most conceited person I've ever met in my life.
Conceited? Because I knew you would come?
I didn't. Dad had to come to Tehuantepec to see his oil wells.
So? Then why are you in Cholula?
We're just passing through.
Oh, you funny little monkey. You come here because you knew this is where your Esteban lives.
That had nothing to do with it, and you're not my Esteban.
Oh, but I am. I make myself a present to you. Oh, Emily, it does not matter. You are here. We are happy. I will show you my friendly country.
Well, Mr. Joy.
To see my country?
Back to our hotel.
You talk of hotels when I'm making love to you.
It's the El Grande. Dad, come on, we must go.
Emily, don't wait. I have much more to say.
You've already said a great deal.
Are we leaving already? No, you must stay.
Yes. Come, Dad, where's our car?
Oh, Esteban, about that gasoline.
Well, it was not necessary, senor. There was plenty of gasoline in the tank. Emily, don't wait. You must not go.
Hurry, Dad.
Emily, why do you act like this? You are angry, but why are you angry? Why?
I prefer not to discuss it.
Senor, you are her father. Ask her why she's angry.
Why are you angry, Emily?
I'm not angry. I never felt more pleasant. Get in, Dad. Goodbye, Esteban. Thanks for the gasoline.
And the gazooza. Ah, great stuff.
It has been my pleasure, senor.
Emilita, why you do this crazy thing? You come, you're happy, you go, you're angry. Why? Why?
Goodbye, Esteban.
So long. Adios. So, this is a pretty arm, I. You little spoiled monkey. Okay, but maybe this time I show you. Oh, caramba, how can I love you so much?
And the curtain comes down on the first act of tonight's play in the Little Theater off Times Square.
Smoking in the outer lobby or downstairs, please.
You are listening to Same Time, Same Station.
Attention, please. Tomorrow morning, how would you like to get a letter with $100 in it? Could you use $100? How about $1,000? How about $5?
Radio made such an impression on people. It, I think, was the most tremendous medium for an actor, for a performer, that has ever been known, because it was so personal. You've heard of people saying, well, I'd get mic fried, I couldn't do it, all that microphone kills me. You don't know the microphone is there, number one, and number two, the thing that makes it so beautifully personal is you're talking to one person. You're not talking to millions of people, and we used to have In those days, it was a tremendous number of people. We used to have 18, 20 million people listening to us.
$10,000 in cash to get your opinion. $500 every week. That is $100 to each of five people.
Second act of Love and Gazooza.
Coffee, senor?
No. Gracias, Pedro. Pedro, listen.
Si, senor.
Pedro, if you love a beautiful senorita, very stubborn, and she does not know what you want, but you know she loves you, though she will not admit it, what would you do?
I think beating is always good, senor.
No, Pedro. Women and horses must never be beaten. It makes them rear up on their hind legs and show their teeth.
I think beating is good. More coffee, senor?
Gracias.
Senor, how do you feel about kidnapping?
Kidnapping? No. She would be a terrible cat.
Si.
What do you mean, si? You mean no?
Si, senor. No.
I might set fire to El Grande Hotel and then dash in a saber from the roaring flames.
What, senor? You own the hotel.
Si.
Don't you think that is right?
But Santa Maria, I must do something. She's my life. She's everything. I cannot lose her again.
Si, senor. Tita.
No, Pedro, no. Do not play now. I have no mood for music.
But, senor, it's mystical, huh? They love the romantic little senoritas. He's strong beneath the window.
Oh, that is it. I will roar like that. Give me the guitar, Pedro. Bring my horse. I go to town. I got to be romantic.
Have a glass of gazooza, Emily. It's delicious.
No, thanks.
Want to go out in the plaza and watch the handsome dons make goo-goo eyes at the senoritas?
Heaven, no.
Well, if you feel like that, why do we hang around here? Why don't we go on to the Wantepec?
No, I don't want to go just yet. The climate here agrees with me.
I give up. Of course, I never thought you'd marry a foreigner, but still, in all, Esteban's a fine chap. I can see how a girl would. In fact, if I loved him enough to come all this way to see him, I'd marry him.
You two would make a lovely couple, dear.
Boy, bring me another bottle of gazooza.
I thought he'd be here by this time.
By George, I wish I could find out who makes that stuff.
He must have been crazy to have thought
that. Gazooza, senor?
Well, if he doesn't care, I don't either. I'm going to bed, Daddy.
It's hot inside. Nice out here in this patio. Hey, waiter, who makes this gazooza?
Why, you wish to know, senor.
Great Scott, why do you all act so suspicious?
No, sorry, senor. We are stranger here.
Good night, Daddy. I'm going in.
Nobody will tell me. You think I was planning to steal the stuff? Where are you going, Emily?
Oh, you... hadn't even tried to see me.
Oh, senorita, how can you be so cold of heart when you are so beautiful? Your lips like red cherries, your cheeks like fragrant peach blossoms.
Stop that. Go away.
So gentle, so little and lovely, I cannot live without you.
This is going to get you anywhere.
Mañana I will learn your name. Mañana I will seek permission of your papa to pay my respects.
Don't be silly. You know my name. You know me.
But tonight I pour out my heart in song beneath your window. Since the moment I saw you, senorita, my heart beats only for you.
Esteban, do you feel all right?
Oh, now you spoil it. You will not pretend with me.
But what sort of talk was that?
Listen. In New York, I make love the Americano way. Now I make love within my own country. I pretend I have seen you with your dueña in the plaza. I come sing beneath the grill of your window. Cuando se le de Havana, valgame Dios. It is beautiful, romantic. But no, you have no imagination.
Well, you needn't get mad. How was I to know you were...
You're a spoiled little brat. You think you can twist me around your finger, but no. I am finished.
Steven, you know, you're not going to let me go away, but back home.
Would you have me beg for love? No. This is the end. Forever.
Steven.
Adios.
I feel lots better as you come along to the Wantapack.
No, Dad, I'm going back to the States. As soon as your train leaves, I'm going back to hotel and pack.
And for Pete's sake, change your clothes.
Oh, stop fussing about these shorts. At least they're cool.
You shouldn't wear shorts down here. These people don't understand the way they look at you.
Oh, get on, Daddy. Oh, wait, your carton of gazooza.
Oh, yes, thanks. I must have that. And nobody will tell me who makes it.
Daddy, your train's moving.
Goodbye, Emily. Be a good girl.
Goodbye, Dad.
Senorita.
Huh?
Oh, 1 minute. I command you to stop. Halt.
What? Do you mean me?
You. Come with me, pronto.
But, wait a minute. Let go of my arm. Let go. Help, police!
Did you call me?
No, not you. You let go of me. I want a policeman.
Me? I am the police.
You? Well, what are you trying to do?
The respectful citizens of Cholula demand I arrest you for running around in the street in your underwear.
Underwear? You mean these shorts? Don't be silly. Oh, let go of me. You can't do this. My father will... I said let go.
Oh, you... Aha! You kick me.
Yes, and I'll...
So now I arrest you again for resisting a policeman of the law.
And the curtain comes down on the second act of tonight's play in the little theater off Times Square.
Smoking downstairs or in the outer lobby, please.
All right, now, here's some more news about the $10,000 that Campana's giving in cash. By the way, if you have this week...
I did 45 shows a week for 2 years solid, once in Chicago. There's another thing to remember. Our studios were spread out all over the place. They weren't in one building. And WGN was either at the Drake Hotel or in the Tribune Tower on Michigan Boulevard. CBS was across the street, WBBM. NBC... was in the Merchandise Mart way down the river on the west side of, just outside of the downtown district. WLS was way out on Washington Boulevard, 1200 and something. And when you had this many shows going for you every day, you had to really hustle to get from one to the other. And I used to drive my own car part of the time, and why, I don't know. I just had a thing about taking cabs. I just wouldn't take cabs. I would either run from one studio to another or take my car and then hassle about trying to find a place to park. Of course, we sort of gave little mordidas to the cops, you know, at Christmas time. Our friends, the police, around the Merchandise Mart, we give them a case of liquor or something, and they always had a space for us. We had men holding the elevator doors, the doors of the building. We had a launch in the river on Michigan Boulevard. So that, for those who don't know, Chicago is intersected by a river, the Chicago River, which at one time in its history was reversed. Its flow was reversed, engineering-wise, so that the sewage wouldn't go into Lake Michigan. Instead, would go down to the drainage canal and on down, I guess, to the Mississippi River, eventually. But anyway, when the bridges were up, for a boat to go through, we were in trouble if we were on the wrong side of the river. So we, a bunch of us, got a launch. We hired a launch and kept this thing waiting for us. And we'd simply jump in the launch, and he'd go around the boat, let us out on the other side, and we'd run for the studio. And as we tore in through the sound lock with actors holding the doors for us, they'd throw a script at you. They were already on the air some of the time. They'd say, you're playing a leading man, a Japanese gardener, and a truck driver. And you just hope that you read the proper voice for the proper character, because you never knew. You didn't know what was coming next. But we became so facile. That's an interesting little comment. Sometimes you have to read for producers who don't know you too well or are rather unsure as to whether to hire you for a thing in a picture. They'd throw a script at you and say, okay, we'll see you in a half hour. You can go out there and study it. And we'd say, why don't we read it? And this would stop them cold, and they'd say, are you sure? We don't want to waste your time. We don't want to waste ours. Why don't you study it? Let me do it. So you'd read the thing, and it'd be a good air reading, you know. And they could see that you could handle your face and your feet and so on. And this would throw them completely. Most of them had never seen this happen before, and they didn't trust us. And I finally found out that it was not a good idea to do this, because they'd say, well, where's he going to go with it from here? That sounded awfully good. I guess not. We better hire somebody else. We'll stand around and, you know.
Hey, what's going on around here?
Who said that?
What? It is Daddy! Listen, I'm on the track of it. I know the man's name. Fellow on the train told me.
Daddy, what are you doing here?
I doubled right back. They said at the hotel you were in jail. What in thunder are you doing in jail, Emily?
Oh, it is all right now, senor. We will have no more trouble with her.
Fine. Listen, Esteban. This Cazuza man lives here in Cholula. His name's Demores, and he has this factory.
What, senor? I am the Cazuza man.
No. His name's Demores.
Esteban de Demores, at your service, senor.
You are the Cazuza. Well, by George.
Why didn't you tell me you were looking for me?
Why? Great Scott, man, I've talked of nothing else. Oh, yes, yes, young man in love. I know. Listen, are you paying attention to me now?
Si, I'm listening, senor.
I want to buy the American rights.
Well, senor, I will make you my partner.
Partner? Say, that's great. We'll go back...
Yes, pardon me for interrupting, but can't somebody give me some of that chicken?
1 minute, darling.
Back to the hotel and draw up the papers. But what about Emily? How'd she get into jail?
Wait, senor. First, I wish to ask you for your daughter's hand.
Don't wait to ask me for anything. Just go marry her before she changes her mind.
Oh, Daddy, you are right. We will marry pronto. Not the mañana, not the next week, but right now.
Oh, Esteban, and then we'll have a beautiful big wedding breakfast.
And the curtain falls on another play hit in the little theater on Times Square.
Darling, that's not it.
It isn't, Nora?
No, it goes like this. 33 fine brews blended into one great beer.
Pabst Blue Ribbon Beer presents The New Adventures of the Thin Man with Nick and Nora Charles, the happiest, merriest married couple in radio. And every Tuesday night at this same time, that international favorite Pabst Blue Ribbon Beer proudly presents the finest in summertime entertainment. So sit back, relax, and pour yourself a tall, foaming glass full of blended, splendid Pabst Blue Ribbon. While you listen to the stars of our show, Claudia Morgan as Nora and Les Tremaine as Nick, in tonight's Adventure of the Thin Man, entitled The Adventure of the Passionate Palooka.
With Claudia Morgan, who was my Nora, played it for about 5 years in New York. My former wife, Alice Reinhardt, was on the show one night, and I had just moved to New York a short time before with a show that Bob Crosby and I used to do in Hollywood. The old gold show, and it was fun because there was the Bobcats Orchestra, and I could sing now and then. And, you know, we had a lot of fun. It moved to New York, and Bob went into the Marines, and we picked up an unknown comedian named Jackie Gleason, about which I will not say too much. And the show folded. And I was sort of at loose ends, and I didn't know just what to do. I wanted to work, and I wanted to freelance, but I don't know, people will have to understand what I mean. After the things that I had done, you couldn't just go out and say, hey, fellas, I want to work. And there were no agents at that time in New York, so it was a matter of making proper contact so that somebody would say, are you interested in working? It's a strange thing that actors have to go through. If you're not starting out, you can't go around with your hat in your hand. So, I was seeing Alice. We were not married. And this particular night, she was on The Thin Man. And I said, oh, I'd love to see it. It's one of my favorite shows. Can I go along? And she said, sure, fine. So we went and did the show. And Hy Brown, who was the director, producer of it, an old friend of mine in New York now, he met me and was very enthusiastic about meeting me and said that he wanted to talk to me. Well, he didn't talk to me. And the following Monday, I was lying in bed, as a matter of fact, debating with myself whether I should call High and say, what did you want to talk to me about, when the phone rang? And it was High. And he is one of the few men in this business I never had a contract with. A handshake, and he paid you the moment the show was over. He kept his checks in his hat, that sort of thing. And he had a wonderful way of talking business by crooning at you, you know. It was so pleasing and so pleasant and so friendly. And I asked me if I would be interested in doing The Thin Man. Well, I nearly fell out of bed, you know. But I said, yes, of course. And we made our little arrangements. The equal billing thing and the same amount of money that the leading lady was getting. You know, that sort of thing. And I did it. Did it for some 5 years. And enjoyed it very much.
And now for the conclusion of tonight's Thin Man adventure.
Hello, Nicky, darling. Where have you been?
To see Scoots and pay him for my half of the bomber.
Oh. How is he?
Very happy. He wishes there were more people like me in the world and less fighters like the bomber.
Well, that's not nice. The bomber really tried hard.
Yeah, I know. The bomber says he would have won the fight if Champ didn't get in his way so much.
I know. But is it Mr. Bomber's fault if there was another man in the ring? Anyway, I'm glad to hear he's going to marry Lulu.
When'd you find that out?
Oh, well, Lulu phoned a few minutes ago.
Well, that's one match I hope he'll win. Nora.
Hmm?
Nora, darling, what are you knitting there?
Can't you guess?
Why, it looks like a little garment. Nora, don't tell me.
Yes, it's true. Jojo's going to have puppies.
Well, then congratulate me.
Why?
After what I went through with that dog, I practically feel like a father. Looks like another hot night tonight.
And if we can't sleep, I know just what to do now.
Huh? Go out again?
No, we'll get into too much trouble that way. We'll each have a glass of ice-cold Pabst Blue Ribbon beer, and then I'll do this. And say good night, Nicky, darling.
Be sure to listen next Tuesday night when Pabst Blue Ribbon Beer brings you another happy, exciting Thin Man adventure with Les Tremaine and Claudia Morgan. Next week, the adventure of the haunted ham, when Nick and Nora go to the country and discover that livestock aren't the only stock in barns during the summer. The Adventures of the Thin Man is brought to you by the Pabst Brewing Company of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, Newark, New Jersey, and Peoria, Illinois. And this is Ed Herlihy saying good night with the best wishes of Pabst Blue Ribbon dealers from coast to coast.
And friends, now that summertime is really here to stay for a while, you'll be planning more and more hot weather meals. You know, an appetizing platter of cold cuts, sliced ham, turkey, corned beef, potato salad, and, of course, plenty of Pabst Blue Ribbon. Nicely chilled in cans or bottles. Better order a good supply today, just so you'll have it in your refrigerator when you get that thirsty feeling. Be sure it's Pabst Blue Ribbon. Blended, splendid. Pabst Blue Ribbon.
This is NBC, the national broadcast.
You played the mic, as we called it. For a whisper, if it was necessary, if the engineer couldn't quite pick you up, then you moved in. But in moving in today on this, as you call it, sophisticated equipment, even at a normal distance and a normal level, I do a great deal of documentary narration, training films, that sort of thing now. And some of these microphones are so sensitive, they ask you not to breathe, swallow, move your mouth, or anything. And how are you going to do that if you're going to talk, you know? But fade-ins and fade-outs, we used to do this all the time. Well, so long, I'll see you later. And then as you come back in, Mom, there you are. I wonder where you were. Door open, door closed. Or if you were shouting, you know, or if you were on the other side of a door, we used to hold our script up and say, yeah, I'm out here. Can you let me in? You know. We were doing a first-nighter show in which Barbara Luddy was playing a portrait hanging over my fireplace. And it was a fantasy, and it was a beautiful thing, and she fell in love with me, and I fell in love with her, and she used to talk to me from the picture, you see. I had a black butler, and in those days, he was played with the typical, I suppose you'd call it typical, southern Negro accent. You know. Well, the picture talked to him as he passed through the room. And, of course, he was supposed to react typically and be scared and practically turn white and so on, you know. And he sort of gave it the ah-wah treatment and, you know, who that? Who talking to me there? You? Well, this was a friend of mine, Forrest Lewis, who did beautiful dialects and still does, as a matter of fact. And he was playing this black butler. Well, when the picture spoke to him, he was supposed to get scared to death and run crashing out of the room. Well, he said, who dad? Who talking to me? And then he's supposed to run, go through the door, and nothing happened. Now, we're on the air, and there are no retakes, there's no tape, nothing. It's a live broadcast. Everybody's electrified, because on top of everything else, you can't kill as much as a second without throwing the timing off and ruining the entire network, who has to come in all across the country for station breaks at a certain second. No, within a few seconds. Well, Forry was very smart and an old-timer, and he said, when the sound effect didn't happen, he tried it again, nothing happened, and the sound man didn't come in, and so Forry said, never mind, where's the door? I'll make one. And he made a heck of a crash and a clatter, which woke the sound man up. I don't mean literally, but for some reason he had lost his place or something. And then he started to make noises, you know, and it sounded like the whole building was coming down. And then we went on with the show, of course. You know, one of the wonderful things about radio, this being so close to people and making so many friends, I had fans from whom I heard for years, some of them up until a few years ago. One lady in Paris, Tennessee, who was bedridden almost constantly from the time her son was born. And she was the wife of a tobacco farmer. And her son grew up and became a minister. And she wrote to me for years. There were, for years on end, and I still have some of them, there was not a handkerchief I owned that she hadn't made for me. Beautifully hem-stitched or embroidered, whatever it is they do to them. I have an Afghan at home right now, a beautiful, warm, tri-colored blue Afghan that she made for me. Luncheon sets, lace banquet cloths, tablecloths, that must have taken her, months on end to make. And she was arthritic, you know. She was pretty badly crippled. She wrote to me once, and she was going to have, this was in the early 40s. 39-40. She was going to have some vertebra removed. And I had never heard of this at that time, and it scared me to death. And I said, before you do anything, please come up here and meet with doctors I know here and see if something can be done. Well, she couldn't make it, so I went down and got her. I drove down to Paris, Tennessee, and brought her up to Chicago. And while she was there seeing doctors, I threw a party for her, and we put her in a big easy chair in the corner of my penthouse living room, and invited everybody I could think of that she would want to see. And Ma Perkins, I remember, was among them, you know. And they all came to the party, and she sat there like Queen Victoria and met them all and just had a ball. She had the most wonderful time. Another was a little lady who was the wife of the mayor of Milledgeville, Illinois. She's no longer there, if she's still with us. Because during the war, she was an elderly lady, but by golly, she went into defense plants and worked her little tail off, and I don't think she ever went back to Milledgeville. Her husband, who was a veterinarian, had had a very unfortunate accident, and a horse had fallen on him while he was treating it. And it had paralyzed him, and he was never out of a wheelchair again, and then passed on, of course. But I have a file at home that I kept for years, and I've never thrown it away, of everyone who ever wrote to me, and my answers to them, what they wanted to know, whether I sent them a picture or not, and all, I have quite a stack of postcard-sized cards in this little file of children who were named after me. Where they incorporated the name Tremaine into their name. Well, I've often wondered what happened to these kids, you know, because there were, oh, I don't know, 50, 75 children named after me during that time. Teenagers? Well, I love them, and I think they're right in a lot of ways about the establishment. There is nothing wrong with being an individual. Sure, you have to get along with your fellow human beings, and there are a lot of mass activities. You can't get away from them. But I would also like to say to them that even though I'm 58 years old, I remember what it was like to be a teenager. I would say to them that we inherited, when we were young, when we were born, the very same problems that the kids today have inherited. Nothing is different. They are approaching we hope, solution to some of the problems much more vociferously than we did. We were kept in line much more with disciplines of one kind and another, moral codes and all that. And there's a place for this. And they'll realize it. The young people today will realize it. I don't mean to preach, but they'll realize it when they get older. There must be things of a cohesive nature to keep a culture, a civilization together. My first recollection is sitting in the chimney corner in London, England, with my mother and my brother and the family cat during the First World War. My first remembrance, they were bombing London with Zeppelins and dropping poison chocolates, which the school kids would eat and die from. So what's new, you know? We've all suffered. Man was made to suffer. Man is a very destructive force. And I don't remember a time all through my 58 years when there wasn't a war of some kind going on somewhere. I am heartily in accord with the young people to do away with wars. But you can't just say, it's gone, and snap a finger and it's gone. Because there are lots of people who don't want it to end. Who don't want peace. And in this country or in other countries. And it's a long, drawn-out process. Takes a lot of patience, and of course, youth doesn't have patience. Unfortunately, you have to learn it. Then they say we compromise. Well, life is full of compromises. You try to remain as structurally intact as you can, but it's very difficult. And I hope they don't think I was preaching at them. But I've enjoyed this very much, and thank you for listening. I feel you near,
yesteryear. Be with us next week for another nostalgic look at radio of yesteryear.
And now it's just about time we were picking up our members and moving along our way. I hope you've enjoyed listening to these songs and the memories that go with them as much as I've enjoyed bringing them to you. And I'll be keeping my weather eye peeled, yes, sir, looking for you all to join us the next time we drop around this way for a friendly little get-together. And I hope that'll be real soon, folks. And until then, this is your old friend Singing Sam saying goodbye for now.
Same Time, Same Station is produced for KRLA News and Public Affairs by John Price. Associate Producer, Cam Currier. Special Research by Martin Halpin. Our thanks to Les Tremaine, our guest tonight.
Be sure to be with us next week at this same time, same station.